And this is the final unit of the series that I'm introducing on the poor, or relationships with the poor. And I'm hoping that this will be the most hopeful one, though it points forward, and hopefully points forward in a hopeful way, but I don't think it will resolve all of the questions that we've raised in the last couple times together either. I call it equally human gifts in disguise, which suggests something of what we're looking for. And I think I'm also supposed to say that I'm David Engelstad as we begin these tapes, so that anyone listening knows who I am. What I'd like to do is to spend this time doing just a tiny bit of review, but then looking forward to ways in which we might experience the poor in a more healthy or positive, holistic way. This is a quote that I just found, and because I like it, I feel like I want to use it, even if it doesn't relate perfectly to what we've done the last 2 days. But Soren Kierkegaard once said, "Life can only be understood backwards, but it must be lived forwards." And there was some commentary on that, of which one quote from this commentary was, "Sorting through old events has just one purpose, to help us come away with insight into who we are and where we are." And so for me, I'll try to relate that quote to what we've done the last couple days. It for me has been important for us not just to say how can we have healthy relationships with the poor, but rather to start first by looking at what inhibits healthy or mutual relationships with the poor. And I'm doing that not so much to cause us some anxiety or to make us feel weighted down with what doesn't work, but in particular to help us understand the ways in which the relationships get very complicated. The first day we simply laid our stories out side by side. We created a picture that kind of looked like a composite story of the people that were gathered here at that time, and then created a picture of the poor as we experienced the poor, and named some things that we thought, that we believed to be a part of their story. And even though there are many places that our stories touched, our experience along those same lines seemed pretty different. And so where we left after the first session was, we're both human, but our life experiences is in some ways radically different. The issues that we're struggling with are quite different. And it leaves us a bit at a loss for easy fellowship together. And we certainly don't have the kind of ease of conversation and relationship that is fostered here. Almost any of us could sit down at the table together and eat and have a pretty easy time conversing and connecting along a variety of levels. One of the things that I raised at the very end of that time together was that, for me at least, an additional complicating factor is that, and I think I used a comparison, if I'm relating to someone, for example, who is grieving, I may not have that experience, but I might be inclined to try to relate to that experience because I expect someday that I will be grieving. So that even if I don't completely understand what they're going through, I might expect that would be helpful for me to relate to them in their grief, through their grief, because I will be facing grief myself. It's probably true that many of us don't expect to face poverty. We don't expect that's an experience that we will have. We may indeed discover somewhere along the line that we are living in poverty. But most of us probably don't expect to be living in poverty. And for me, that makes it more difficult to pay attention to their stories because it doesn't feel as if it's as immediately applicable. It won't necessarily allow me, by relating to their story, to deal with that situation more gracefully because I don't expect to deal with that situation anyway. So that was in some ways kind of the nuts and bolts of the first time together. And then yesterday we explored how relationships get complicated when we enter them as problem solvers or as helpers and identify ourselves as the one to solve the problems of the poor and identify them as the people who are helpless and unable to solve their own problems and establish what I was calling a codependent relationship, where expectations and responsibility gets really cloudy and it's not very clear who's taking care of whom, and there's plenty of places for each party to become very frustrated with the other's efforts. We set each other up in many ways to fail miserably. Though because we're often inclined to be helpers, we oftentimes keep coming back because we want to do something, but we may simply set our sights inappropriately in that helping process. So we talked a bit about codependency. And now what I want to talk about is to point up what for me would be the shape of, or something that might point us to, a more healthy kind of relationship. And I think I'll choose to use the language of pointing to, because I don't see this happening easily or commonly. But it's for me something that I have found is important, and I suppose especially as a pastor, important for us to look at. And I call it a way of seeing, not unlike what Dan Erlander does in his book, Baptized We Live, a way of seeing. When I use that term, there is some real helpful language that has come to me by way of the Native American tradition. And there was a professor at Luther Northwestern Seminary named Steve Charleston who first used this language, and I've liked it. He said that, as he observes it, the Western peoples, Western Christians, oftentimes will say, or at least imply, "I'll believe it when I see it." And for me, that has, you know, one of the figures that we can kind of rally behind with that kind of mentality is our friend Thomas, who, when confronted with the evidence of the resurrection, said, "I won't believe unless I see," and demanded that kind of proof. And he said, in the Native American tradition, we turn that around, and we say, "You won't see it until you believe it." Okay? You won't believe it, you won't see it until you believe it. And that's the other side of the Thomas story, where Jesus said, "Blessed are those who have not seen and yet believe." So how do we see each other as equally human? How do we see each other as gifts? And I say gifts in disguise because I think sometimes it takes a little bit of work to uncover the gift. I think it starts with believing. And so I want to spend just a little time with that and then open it up for some discussion. This goes back a little bit in terms of what we've done. I think I laid out about four different things, things that what I would call darken our sight, that make it difficult for us to see each other as a gift. And this is kind of the last that I'll do of review. The first is, I think we cannot see the poor as a gift if all we focus on is their problems. Especially when I remember, just when I visualize the list of problems we listed the other day about the poor. If that's what we focus on, if that's what we see when we look at the poor, is this huge list of problems, it's hard to imagine that we would be able to see them as a gift. I think also that we cannot see the poor as a gift if we're threatened by our differences, by their story. And in that regard, I would say that it's okay to feel guilty when confronted with their story. But any change that happens as a result of interacting with the poor and hearing their story has to be of our own choosing. And that flashes back to a little bit of what we talked about yesterday. Thirdly, I think we cannot experience the poor as a gift if we look at them as more or less human than ourselves. And sometimes, though I don't know if I'm wise in doing this, I call that the liberal or the conservative dilemma. It feels like sometimes liberals idolize the poor. It feels like sometimes conservatives look down at the poor. If you're a liberal or a conservative and want to take issue with that, I'm kind of shooting from the hip, so you can take pot shots at me afterwards. But either way, either putting the poor up on a pedestal or looking down at them, either way, it makes it difficult to be in a mutual relationship with them. And then what we said yesterday, I think you can't experience the poor as a gift. We can't experience the poor as a gift in a codependent relationship. And for me, in that kind of relationship, you reap exactly what you sow. We'll always get exactly what we bargained for, what we expected and demanded from one another. I thought of an example, kind of a silly one. In a codependent relationship, it feels a bit like you're doing business with a used car salesperson. And by that I mean you're in a bargaining process, if you don't hold up for your end of the bargain, you can feel like you're taken. And if you get too good a deal, you can feel suspicious that maybe there was something wrong with the car in the first place. But it never quite feels comfortable. It never feels very comfortable. So those are the things that I think darken our sight. We've spent some time on that. What are some pointers? What are some things that help us out? For me, I draw upon our faith tradition, and I'm going to share a few Bible passages that are significant for me, and I would invite us to spend some time together then, sharing what we all have found significant in terms of helping us to see the poor in a different light. How can we see them as equally human? How can we see the poor as gifts? This could apply to any other kind of people, but I'm applying it at this point just to the poor. Better not put this down. I've written my comments so small that I can't quite see it down there. So I'll share just a few scripture passages which are meaningful for me in terms of putting on a new way of seeing. One of them, I think, all of these I think should be pretty familiar. The first one is from Psalm 139, verses 13 through 16. And it jumps into the middle of a psalm, but it's a part speaking about how God has created us. And the psalmist writes, "For thou didst form my inward parts, thou didst knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise thee, for thou art fearful and wonderful. Wonderful are thy works. Thou knowest me right well. My frame was not hidden from thee when I was being made in secret, intricately wrought in the depths of the earth. Thy eyes beheld my unformed substance. In thy book were written every one of them, the days that were formed for me, when as yet there was none of them." I read that not just as a statement of the psalmist's own experience, but as a way to understand that each of us was made by God in an especially wonderful and unique fashion. And it helps me to read this psalm to think that every human being that God creates is made in exactly the same fashion. And like unto that kind of passage is Genesis 1, verses 27 and 31, where God says, "So God created man and woman in God's own image. In the image of God were they created, male and female. And God blessed them," and then at the end, "God saw everything that was made, and behold, it was very good. All were made in the image of God." God declares that the creation is good, and I can expect that that continues to hold true, not just for us, but for the poor. Another one, which is a little more pointed, is Paul's analogy of the body of Christ to a body with many members. I think I want to read verses 18 through 27. And he seems to have in mind the tension that exists between those people who understand themselves to be kind of especially important and those people that are perceived to be less important parts of the body. So Paul writes to a congregation, picking it up again in the middle, "But as it is, God arranged the organs in the body, each one of them as God chose. If all were a single organ, where would the body be? As it is, there are many parts, yet one body. The eye cannot say to the hand, 'I have no need of you,' nor again the head to the feet, 'I have no need of you.' On the contrary, the parts of the body which seem to be weaker are indispensable, and those parts of the body which we think less honorable, we invest with the greater honor. And our unpresentable parts are treated with greater modesty, which our more presentable parts do not require. But God has so composed the body, giving the greater honor to the inferior part, that there may be no discord in the body, that the members may have the same care for one another. If one member suffers, all suffer together. If one member is honored, all rejoice together. There's a couple other pieces that I'd like to share, but I think I want to share them after we do some discussion. One is just kind of an ongoing example of Mildred, who I've talked about a couple times, and how some of this applies for me. But I'd like to at least see where we're at this point and invite you to reflect with me on two questions, which are essentially the questions I have for this time together. One is, what helps you to see the poor as equally human, as gifts in disguise? Or how does your faith help you to see the poor as equally human, as gifts in disguise? And in that regard, kind of a related question, which if it doesn't seem to kind of fall out naturally, I'll throw in the story about Mildred, and we can see if that helps. Who has the Spirit led you to connect with? We've talked about trying to build relationships, but I think the Spirit puts certain people in our way. Who has the Spirit led you to connect with? I'm thinking in particular of the poor. And what have you learned by pursuing that relationship or those relationships? Does it feel awkward jumping in at this point, or is it?
Maybe this answers. I mean, is answer your question. Maybe it's not, but yes, it relates to what you said earlier too. One of the things that I've learned, or in thinking about stuff, is that the poor people don't necessarily see their lives as one big bundle of problems.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we might see their lives as one big bundle of problems, because if we had to tackle all that stuff, it would seem real strange to us, because we're not normally having to deal with those problems. We have different ones.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if we can somehow realize that they don't view their lives as one big bundle of problems, we maybe can find ways to, you know, share their joys about their children or about their marriage or whatever, you know, things that aren't problems for them. When they bring them up, listen to what it is that they're saying about things that aren't problems. Don't just focus on, you know, I need help here. Oh, now I need to really listen.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and that's really interesting. It flashes, some lights are flashing for me. I think I've thought of this before, but it just jumped into my mind now. When I'm talking with someone who's poor, say it's someone that's in our emergency shelter or whatever, I'm probably not inclined to lay out my problems, but if I do, I don't recall having the experience that the poor are just jumping in trying to solve my problems. At least the people that I've met, seem to be able to listen to my problems. Maybe they think I'd gladly trade you for those problems, I don't know. But the people that I've met seem to be able to listen to my problems without jumping in and fixing them. But that's some of what we talked about yesterday. I'm maybe built in such a way, many of us are built in such a way, that we're less inclined to listen without feeling like we have to respond or do something. And maybe it's there's kind of both sides. They aren't just problems, they're people. But they also have problems just like we do. Yeah, that's a good point.
Well, I think the environment that you live in, you are faced with these things. Where I live is a very affluent community.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have much contact with really poor people. I mean, mm-hmm. there are different degrees, certainly. So I know I'm certainly aware Santa Barbara isn't that far from where I am, and we are involved in a shelter there,
mm-hmm.
and through some of the people that go work there, and we send food there, so I hear some, but I understand there that they screen the people pretty carefully, and they are people who at least have some direction in where
mm-hmm.
they want to go, and that's where they're trying to help them find jobs,
mm-hmm.
if that's what their problem
mm-hmm.
is, to help them find houses. if that's what their problem is, and find medical help if they need it, that sort of thing. And not, I know there are many homeless people, but a lot of the homeless people want to live that way, you know. Don't try to do something with me. This is the way I want to live. And of course, they're not all that way, surely.
There was maybe I'll throw this in now. Unless, are other people, did anyone else want to jump in with something? I don't want to cut anyone off. There, just what you said triggered something that I was going to share eventually, a story from Luke, and it gets a little bit complicated, but my exegetical method is such that I can pull out what I want from it and discard the rest. One gets to be a little bit...
We all get real good at those.
Yep. This is it's a story about Jesus sending the disciples out, 70 strong, to do ministry. And I'll read just verses out of chapter 10 from Luke 1 and 2 and 5 through 11. After this, the Lord appointed 70 others and sent them on ahead of him, two by two, into every town and place where Jesus himself was about to come. And he said to them, "The harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Pray therefore the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into his harvest." And then it goes on. I'll pick that up. So they're sent out. And then these are some instructions. There's just a part of the instructions. Whatever house you enter, first say, "Peace to this house." And if a son or daughter of peace is there, your peace shall rest upon him or her. But if it is not, it shall return to you. And remain in the same house, eating and drinking what they provide, for the laborer deserves his or her wages. Do not go from house to house. Whenever you enter a town and they receive you, eat what is set before you, and then do the work of the kingdom. But whenever you enter a town and they do not receive you, go into its streets and say, "Even the dust of your town that clings to our feet, we wipe off against you. Nevertheless, know this, that the kingdom of God has come near." Well, it sounds a little bit harsh, but I thought, you know, it's typically American for us to sing songs like Dream, to dream the impossible dream, and we've got shows like Mission Impossible. I'm beginning to see that some of that seems to also be remarkably consistent with a kind of codependent mentality. We always choose Mission Impossible. You know, we choose to save those people who are the hardest case, who are the most resistant, who don't want to recover, who don't want to be helped. I chased many an alcoholic in my first day in the parish who didn't want to recover and spent incredible amounts of energy trying to get them into treatment, the finest treatment programs, and trying to orchestrate all the individuals that you need to, you know, get someone into treatment. And no matter how well laid out my efforts were, how caring, how supportive I was, if the person didn't want to recover, or didn't want to recover, they usually found within one day a way to sabotage the treatment program. And almost always that same person would probably come back and say, "Well, you know, this wasn't the right setting, but I think maybe this other setting would be better." I learned gladly that that didn't work. But there seems to be some truth to the fact that in relationships, in ministry, the Spirit does something to open or close hearts at that given time. And we're not called to keep beating our heads against the wall with people who don't want to be in relationship with us, who resist relationships with us. It doesn't mean always leave them alone, but I think that for me, when I, in my pair setting, encounter anyone, in particular now thinking of the poor, who seems resistant to the efforts, I'm not inclined to push it any further than that. If the relationship, if whatever, doesn't seem to be working, I don't choose to wipe my feet and kind of burn my bridges, say, you know, "Don't ever come back here." But on the other hand, I don't decide to, you know, that they will be my, you know, my project for the month, and I'll spend all my attention on that person. And so some of what you were saying, I was triggered by some of your thoughts about screening people. I think some of that's real appropriate. There are people who are ready to be helped. And for the people, especially the people who are ready to work at, to take some responsibility for their own lives, that's a group for whom our work, our relationships can make a real difference. And for the other people, I think we kind of have to listen to how the Spirit tugs us in terms of what to do. What kind of ministry do we leave them with?
I think so much of our relief work is done not so much our feeling of the people we're trying to help, but it makes us feel good.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you know, we did this and we did that and mm-hmm. we helped these people. And I'm just always reminded of Pearl Buck's book that she wrote about her father. I can't remember, something about Beloved Angel or something like that. And of course, I thought she was pretty harsh, but her father going to China as a missionary, and she said he went more for the satisfaction it gave him, baptizing all these people, and not because she felt he was concerned about what happened to these people. You know. And I think our attitude so often, in whatever way we try to help people, it's done for the satisfaction we get out of it, and that's not right.
Mm-hmm. That's right, yeah.
I don't think it has to be a dreadful thing.
No.
Hand, you know, but I mean, mm-hmm. there is, you have to, we do have to constantly be questioning. That's related to
why
we're
doing this. Yes. Yeah.
That's right. Yep.
And I think our whole welfare program is beginning to realize that it's perpetuating rather than really helping these people. And I think now, I just heard before I left home about welfare reform, that they are no longer going to make it necessary for the father to leave the home in order for the mother to get help. Mm-hmm. That it is possible for a two-family home to get help, and that the emphasis is going to be on education and on training, unless they are willing to go into a program where they will learn how to make a living and take care of their family, that then their assistance will not continue, sort of forcing them. But that's kind of the dual responsibility, not making them more dependent, but making them more independent comes in. And I think that's, to my way, that's the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I struggle with in my personal relationships with the poor, and the congregation that I served was kind of in a, the people it served were suburbanites, but it was in an area that was very mixed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, right behind us was Big Country Club, and 2 miles away were lots of Oriental folks, and the apartment complex half a block away was one of the places that I wouldn't go in alone because of so much drug traffic, you know. And so folks would sometimes come by, it was a major highway, and folks would sometimes just see the sign and call or whatever, I'd establish relationships with people. They needed rides to WIC, or they needed food for their children, or, you know, whatever kind of, what was going on. And I'd spend time with them over 2 or 3 weeks, and other members in the congregation would be, you know, trying to connect in with them and stuff. And it was real hard to know when was it appropriate for the relationship to end. Was I supposed to be the one that kept it going? You know, was I supposed to be always going over and saying, well, how are you doing? What do you need? You know, or, you know, or like you say, inviting them over to my home, or taking them out for, you know, ice cream or whatever. When was it appropriate for those relationships to end? I mean, if nothing had developed personally, when it was always uncomfortable. One of those happened right at the end of my time there in May. A woman had come by and needed just some real basic things and was really doing a good job of finding herself work and had really experienced a lot of recent real traumas. Her child was taken away during the time that I was working with her, and that I had known her in. But she was really taking care of herself. You know, she found another job after she lost one, and, you know, I was supportive of that. She was looking for another one, and but we didn't really get to know each other personally. And when she quit calling for help, you know, when it's like, I don't need help anymore, I went over there one or two times to try to find her an apartment, just kind of see how she was doing, and she wasn't there. But it's kind of like, now, how long am I supposed to keep this going? There was never really a clear answer for me, you know, as to how do you do that, you know?
A clear, can I just push that one
sure.
more step? A clear answer in terms of what you felt with her, or was there any prompting by the Spirit, by God, to kind of give you any direction, or was it all just kind of...
Well...
Sometimes, I mean, it isn't always that easy. Sometimes
right.
I feel like the Spirit's tugging on me a little bit to stay with it, but sometimes those signals are not clear. And I was just curious what you meant by...
Well, this relationship was so strange because I knew at the time that she came into my life,
mm-hmm.
I knew that I was leaving within 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And so it was real strange, you know, how much to connect.
Mm-hmm. Because
you're
leaving.
I mean, I was saying goodbye to so many people that I really wasn't able to say hello to hardly anybody at that point. So.
Yeah.
And the other household that I was involved with more, I don't know, it was real hard for me to sort that stuff out. You know, I guess I didn't see the Spirit, you know, pulling me or encouraging me
mm-hmm.
in any particular way except in a more general way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so.
Did these people come to you only when they needed something? They didn't come.
This is how those two particular people came into
because I would think that would be some help. If they never seek you out except when they need some help,
right?
Then they evidently wouldn't feel any personal relationship other than this need.
But that's part of that whole codependent thing. I didn't have to just respond when they came to me for help either.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I could have gone over to their home and said, I mean, particularly with Patsy, this one woman that I knew and her two children, who was a real responsible woman. I mean, I'd tell her, I'm going to be there to pick you up at 7. She had to call me on the phone because she didn't have a phone. And we'd work out times when I would pick her up or whatever to take her to WIC or wherever she needed to go. And I'd say, I'm going to be there at 7:30 so we can get in early and it won't take us a whole lot of time. You know, can you have your children ready? Yeah, I will. And only about one time out of 5 was she still in bed. And the other 4 times, she had those kids up, scrubbed, and ready to go at 7:30 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know any of my friends who would have their 2 kids under the age of 3 up, scrubbed, and ready to go at 7:30 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, occasionally I'd stop by just to see how she was, or we'd go get an
mm-hmm.
ice cream cone or something like that. But, I mean, it was, all of a sudden it just ended.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they moved, their situation kind of changed, her husband was working steadily, and so there was another person involved in the household, and I think all that stuff, the relationship shifted. And it was like, well, should I have kept that going, or, you know.
But don't you run into this on any relationship? Not like you come here and you meet people, and some you have,
mm-hmm.
and some maybe you go away and you keep relationships going,
mm-hmm.
and others you enjoy while you're here, but...
Except seeing as all of my relationships with the poor have ended, and not all of my relationships with people in the summer haven't ended, I have to say, something must be a little different here.
And that's a concern for me. I mean, that's what you're raising is kind of at the heart of my personal exploration right now, and what I'm kind of struggling with our congregation. It seems like that always happens. Our relationships with the poor find a way to end when other relationships persist.
A certain percentage of other relationships.
Yeah. Yep. Some always persist, and there are. It's hard to do a unit on the poor without throwing in a couple verses like this. This is from Luke. You know, he's the hardest, I think, on us in terms of our wealth, but. But they point to something else, which is important for me as I think about a way of seeing the poor, a way of seeing ourselves. I was going to pick the rich young ruler, but that's you all know that story. This is another one, like unto it, from Luke 12:32. Fear not, little flock, for it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. That's the good news. Sell your possessions and give alms. Provide yourselves with purses that do not grow old, with a treasure in the heavens that does not fail, where no thief approaches and no moth destroys. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. And I think that it's all our wealth is always a factor in the relationships with the poor. And there's, for me, as yet, not been a relationship with anyone who is poor that has been as easy or attractive as have been my relationships with people whose life experience is more unto mine, whose social status is roughly the same, whose education level is roughly the same. And what I'm coming to believe is that my life as a Christian, my life as a human, will be enriched by relationships with the poor. That's a faith stance. But what that means in reality is I might need to persist at some relationships that I'm not so naturally inclined to pay attention to. And go ahead.
I keep thinking about Candy, and Candy is a friend of mine, and she's a young unwed mother, mm-hmm. and Joshua is now 4, so we've known Candy for maybe 2-3 years. He was just a toddler when she first walked in to our church, and lives in the apartments close by. And I guess Candy is poor. She lives on welfare. But I think she's poor in many other ways because of her background has been void of so much that, and we learn this, you know, little by little. And I've had so many questions in dealing with her, but mm-hmm. one is, you know, do I want her, in order to be my friend, to gain all of these experiences so then, you know, we mm-hmm. or do I say, I accept you as my friend even though you don't have those experiences, and then, but where do we connect then?
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember, my one job with Candy is to take her grocery shopping, mm-hmm. she doesn't have a car. And although I could do many other things, and I could always babysit, and I decided no, you know, so my one project is to take her grocery shopping, and that's been fine, and other people do other things that she needs for help. And I keep hoping, you know, that she'll make it someday. Mm-hmm. And then I think, well, what do I mean by making it? But I think I do have the hope that someday she'll be able to, well, just support mm-hmm. herself and Josh and have a better feeling about herself. You know, and I think just...
But then don't you have to say... Is she supporting herself and Josh now? And is she feeling good about herself?
I don't think so.
Okay, I mean, yeah. I mean, you'd know that.
Yeah.
Or she would. I mean.
Yeah. She's trying to get her education, and I think eventually she'll do that. However, she's getting a degree that is not at all practical.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Many of us have those and still support
yeah.
ourselves.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah. I'm hearing your reflection on this is wonderful.
It's gone on for a long time, and I think I've changed a lot of mm-hmm. ideas, mm-hmm. you know, since she's come into our life. You mentioned project, taking somebody on as a project, and I really go like this when I
sure.
hear that.
Sure.
Because the first year, we have students in our church from Lutheran Northwestern, and this one gal was with us her first year in school, and she kind of took Candy on as a project
mm-hmm.
for the year.
Great.
And was a really good friend.
Mm-hmm.
And Candy, you know, didn't really have the experience of friends before, and she does need friends. So this was really great, and this gal would help her babysit, and she would have her over for dinner, and then Candy made dinner one time and invited her over, and we all thought this was really great, and this was really healthy. At the end of the year, the gal moved and didn't tell Candy where she moved, and so, I mean, it had been her project.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And then she cut it off. Wait, that made me so angry.
Mm-hmm.
But since then, I can understand why the gal had to cut it off, because she, you know, was really burned out.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that she was, you know, felt that she had been taken advantage of. Well, you know, if you have all of a sudden have one friend, it's easy to burn that friend out.
Yeah. And I don't know what this other seminary student learned, but where there's a person that's taken advantage of, there's someone that's willing to be taken advantage of. Yeah. And I come across all these wonderful quotes. You can't be walked on unless you're lying on the floor. There has to be some willingness, you know, in that process too. And sometimes helpers will tolerate abuse out of many different rationale or stances. But the I think for me, as I listen to your story, I like what I hear, just in terms of the way you're reflecting on it. And the same thing is happening for me in my relationship with Mildred. This woman that I've mentioned a couple
Mildred
times.
Too.
Sure. And, you know, I got hooked by her story with all this rejection. And one piece that I didn't share with you is that after, you know, we kind of drew her into our congregation because she'd been rejected by everyone, foster parents and other churches. You know, she shared with me that she did have two friends. You know, two pastors had befriended her. One had been this, you know, I heard wonderful stories. He had done everything for her. But now he was in International Falls, which... from Minneapolis, if you know, the lay of the land is a ways off. And the other was, as she painted him, a real fundamentalistic preacher who was out to change her and told her she shouldn't be at this church and all the rest, you know, this big, heavy influence, of course. So she had set up, you know, these two pastors as in sort of different polarities and was inviting me to find my place, you know, as a healthy, supportive, sensitive pastor that would invite her over for meals and have her in to do laundry and all the rest. And, of course, I welcomed that, took on that challenge. But now, and I think I've shared with you that, you know, part of my journey in these last 5 years of ministry is to discover my own dysfunction, my own codependency, and that's... I'm grateful that this congregational setting has pushed me into doing some recovery. I'm glad I'm not persisting in this for the rest of my life. For my own sake and the people that I do ministry with and just am in relationship with. But now I'm trying to look at what can I make of that relationship. We've spent time together. It may not have been healthy, but is there something salvageable? And I was thinking about your... choosing to go grocery shopping with Candy. With other friends, a lot of times it seems like it takes some kind of events to get going at first. Yeah. We don't just sit down and talk. I choose to go to a ball game. It may not be taking someone shopping, but it's not so dissimilar in character. There is a way that we kind of gradually come to be comfortable with one another. And for better or worse, I've learned some of Mildred's story, albeit in kind of unhealthy way. And now what I'm trying to do is to see what's maybe possible in my relationship with Mildred. She is one that there's a story in Luke about a woman who just kind of persists at this judge, and without kind of playing anymore with that story, it's just her persistence gets kind of held up by Jesus as a model of God responding to people when they ask. Mildred is very persistent in terms of the relationship. Very persistent. She always remembers me on special occasions with cards and other things. And while some of that is problematic, she doesn't go away. And as I listen to God's Spirit talking to me, I think, you know, is there a reason why Mildred persists in this relationship? Is there some reason why God wants me to stay with it? At the present time, I think there is. And I'm still trying, you know, to put on that new way of seeing, to see that she was intricately wrought, that she was created in the image of God and all that stuff. I haven't quite seen yet exactly what gift she has to give me, though, you know, there's some subtle things going on. The way she lives her life, I think I'm less afraid of poverty than I used to be. I think I'm more acutely aware of my wealth than I used to be. And I may come to name those as very significant gifts at some point, as opposed to just little gifts. they don't feel like such personal gifts, but spiritual gifts, they're great. But I'm also trying to trust that if I believe she's a gift, that something of that same, that I might see some of that now and not just believe that it's there. Yes, Thor.
I personally don't have any real contact with any of the poor. And what I'm hearing, and I may have, because I haven't been in any of the other sessions,
mm-hmm.
I hear this one-to-one mm-hmm. basis of poor,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How you're all working through the church and,
mm-hmm.
on a one-to-one basis. And I think your idea is to try and understand the poor through one person. But then I hear the other statement that the welfare program is not producing any results that are changing anything, and that they need, there's somewhere out there we need training and rehabilitation and in some other form than the welfare program, which I believe partly too. But that's where we just kind of shove it away and say they need that. But see, that's a real broad part of the poor problem.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're trying to straighten out or understand one individual, that's fine too. But maybe you should be. Do we take over the role as a one-to-one and try to retrain that person?
Mm.
Put them in school or something?
Yeah.
Or what?
Yep.
What do we really do? Or do we say, they out there, who is that they that's going to do that? Take that dumb welfare program out of the picture and put in something good. Who are they?
Yep.
Because that's so easy for our society to just to push it away and walk away from it. And I'm the same way.
One thing I did in the first session, which might have been helpful, I was trying to frame the time together thusly, that I think for most of us, we are involved, or many of us have been involved on a more service-oriented or helping professional kind of level. And our church, for example, is involved in many projects or outreach ministries that address broader needs of the poor as a kind of a community, as a group of people. And that's, it feels like that's a whole topic of discussion, which I think is very valuable, but it wasn't the one that I was choosing to focus on. And for me, what is curious out of that and what I wanted to spend time with in these sessions is simply as individuals who oftentimes participate in that same kind of service network and who find ourselves more and more hearing things which prompt us to focus on the poor, to sort of see them as people that God wants us to connect with as much as our other neighbors next door and any other of God's creation, that that I'm curious that in this desire to connect, most of our friendships, our friendships don't seem to be just in general with the poor. And what's going on there? So I've really focused on the question and what's going on that our friendships aren't with the poor, and just trying to understand some of the dynamics. It's also a belief of mine that we learn about the poor in two very different ways, but in both of them helpful ways, by both being service providers and being in relationship. I've learned a great deal by working to coordinate and supervise a shelter or a language project or, you know, food shelf or other kinds of outreach to the poor. But I also feel like I have a lot to learn by being in relationship with those same people and listening to their stories and developing friendships and letting that work its own kind of change of perspective, change of seeing, way of seeing. And I think the reason that I want to focus on it is that I think it's easier for me to spend my time volunteering at the shelter or teaching an English language class than it is to simply develop a relationship. Mildred is not the only poor person that I'm in relationship with, but her story is kind of paradigmatic. They're all a little bit like that. They're never very easy. They're all complicated, prone to codependency, caretaking, problem solving. they're kind of one up, one down, going back and forth. I'm up and then I'm down, and they're just difficult. And I've been interested in exploring with you how that works, and if there's a way to understand those relationships a little better, if for no other reason than maybe to persist in those a little longer and possibly in a little more healthy way. So that's kind of what I've been after.
Do most of these people come to you because they are materially poor?
By these people, you mean to our church or just the ones that...
Now this Mildred, did she come because she was destitute financially or whatever, or did they come for other reasons?
The poor, we've spent some time kind of defining the poor, and it's still kind of a big fuzzy thing. For me, materially poor is a part of the equation, and Mildred lives on $437 a month. She gets from Social Security Disability, and she has an apartment. She was in an apartment that rented for $190 a month. It was not an efficiency. It didn't have any kitchen facilities, but
she
had more disposable income.
Because she needed help because...
Well, no, she came... No, she's stubbornly independent and largely survives without financial assistance. She isn't on food stamps. She really... rigidly takes care of herself financially. Every once in a while, one time she was robbed, and it just that tore her apart because she wasn't able to kind of go on it by herself. And she doesn't in particular. I mean, she's unique, or a unique person, so she makes her own choices. But she doesn't choose to use the food shelves or any of the food programs, the hot meals, loaves and fishes, whatever you call them, food lines, soup kitchens. She feels that $437 is what is her income that I guess she feels that she deserves, and she gets that, and then she feels that she's accountable to live on that. So that's what she chooses to survive on. And
so she didn't come to you because...
Nope,
she
came for community.
Okay, yeah.
And she's incredibly needy emotionally. Yeah. Very needy emotionally. In some ways it'd be easier if I could just give her $5. But she came for community's sake. She joined our church with a history of rejection.
People you meet on all levels of income. They don't have to be poor.
Yeah. And with Mildred, she dared us to do better, you know, not to reject her like all those other people. And she's still there. I mean, it's kind of funny. I think a sense of humor is helpful. You know, otherwise it could get too serious.
You're not bald yet.
I'm not bald yet. No, my hair isn't. My hair, if it's going white, and I have a few white hairs, it's more from children than it is from Mildred.
Mine's inherited.
I just keep thinking of the story of Elijah and the widows of Zarephath. Mm-hmm. I don't know if there's something in that for us in thinking about this, but, you know, Elijah approaches this woman, and of course mm-hmm. he didn't know that she's poor, I guess, mm-hmm. at first, mm-hmm. and she didn't have much, and she offers him what she has, and it lasts as long as necessary, and Elijah gives her some gifts along the way, hanging out with her, and I that story just keeps coming back into my mind.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. That's a beautiful image.
I find the people who are poor in spirit are much more difficult to help. Mm-hmm. Reach mm-hmm. than the ones who are poor materially.
Yes.
That's been my experience.
Yeah. And they don't always go hand in hand, maybe not as often as we want to picture it. But as we talked about the other day, if we continue to treat the poor as helpless, that tends to foster that poverty of spirit, because they tend to become what we tell them they are, incapable of taking care of themselves, helpless, unable to be responsible for their own lives. And, you know, what kind of person could they be if they're unable to take care of themselves? Well, not very good. So it seems like there's some real powerful stuff that can happen, even if we're never, even if we don't foster long-term relationships, simply in believing that they are not helpless, that they're capable, we communicate a rather powerful message.
Yeah, I'm always amazed with Candy that she really does seem to be doing a great job with Josh, mm-hmm. with her little boy.
Mm-hmm.
And I keep thinking, how does she manage to do that? You know, it seems to be compensating really good, you know, with all the problems she has.
Yeah.
Because you remember, do you have children? Yeah, I mean, you remember how hard it was. How was she doing so well?
Yeah, it was a real struggle.
Sure.
You know, and here with all of these problems she has, he seems to be just real healthy emotionally. And and I think, you know, she was pretty abused when she was growing up. And so, you know, that was a real concern of mine, that Josh was going to be abused along the way. And, you know, that hasn't happened.
That's great. I think we may have to end with that, but that seems like a good place to end. Thank you all of your comments, for coming to one, two, or three of these sessions. This has been fun. And I'm going to be here, just for your information, for two more weeks. So,
Or you want to be doing some more teaching, Dave?
Yeah, next week, or this coming week, I'm doing a three-part series on shame, codependency, and addiction. And I've learned from this week, I will set those up in such a way that they will be individual presentations. So if you can make one, we'll try to talk about the problem and then, or the dysfunction, and then incorporate recovery into each piece, so that if you choose to come to one or two or three, you wouldn't feel unresolved. I had started this session, never having taught here before, I had thought I'll just do a three-part series. Having gotten up here, I realized it's really hard to make three in a row. I haven't made three in a row of anything since I've been here this last week. The best I did was to plan on doing two of a three-part series of someone else's, and I ended up making it to one.
Have they changed the time on this several times, too? Some of them, I noticed, they're bouncing the time around, which they didn't used to do, and that makes it almost impossible for me to be able to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know how consistent they're being with time.
I think they're trying to move it around so that staff can go to pieces,
right.
even if they can't go to all.
Yeah.
That is going to change the way you have to teach.
So, because I had envisioned this as kind of a, you know, one piece would lead into the next.
Yeah.
And that's fine for me, but it's not so good for you. So we'll do it in three different units. And it will be an exploration of how that language can help us understand our own experience. It will be necessarily simplistic, and you can't get too far, but it'll also be a workshop kind of environment, because I'm discovering that people have, especially around those issues, shame, codependency, and addiction, a wealth of experience. So I think it will work just fine to learn from each other.
Mine is to food.
Yes. Oh, sure.
Addiction.
There's, if you look at the lists now of kind of self-help groups or 12-step groups, it's huge. I mean, all of the different kind of addictions that they're identifying. I've heard almost anything they say that's powerful and pleasurable can be addicting.
Like mountain climbing and all that.
Yeah. Oh, sure. Exercise.
Living in the wilderness.
So,
thank you, Dave.
You're welcome. Thanks for coming. Thanks for sharing.
The stuff that you shared yesterday right at the beginning, when you kind of laid out codependency and said, when I do this, this happens. I don't remember exactly how you did it. You know, it was just like, please don't be so clear to me. I mean, that's kind of the struggle of ministry for me. You know, the whole, you know, how do you remain engaged and yet not be the salvation of these people? Because that's what they want sometimes, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, you know.
And sometimes I think they want it because we're willing to take it on. And there was a counselor that I've worked with recently who uses the terms over-adequacy, under-adequacy, or over-responsible, under-responsible. Mm-hmm. And wherever you have someone who's willing to be over-adequate, over-responsible, you foster the under-adequacy, under-responsibility. Mm-hmm.